Good morning and welcome to All Sides Weekend / Books. This is one of my favorite parts of being here, where we're going to talk about what's new, what's hot, what's not in books. We have a brand new guest for the panel today, but let me introduce Cassie Rose, who is WOSU's book critic and the chatelaine of the website thelongestchapter.com.
Thank you. Good morning.
Kevin Griffith, to give us some class, is the professor of creative writing and poetry at Capital University. And our new guest is Eric Obanoff, who is the founder and director of $2 Radio.
Correct.
Which is a small press. I don't like to say that, but it's... How would you describe it?
We describe ourselves as a boutique publisher.
A boutique publisher, okay. Based now here in Columbus.
Correct. We're in Columbus. We publish 5 to 6 books a year, mainly novels. What we would characterize as bold literary fiction, you know, which can have many different faces. What we're looking for, I guess, are just strong, authorial voices, a distinct vision, authority over language and the world that they're creating.
And books that'll sell.
Right,
we are going to talk about a $2 press, and we're going to have some book recommendations and ask for your phone calls. I'm always interested to know what people out there are reading. And, you know, you could also respond to some of the recommendations given to us by our panel. So I just want to start with Eric. I interrupted you just to do the sort of nuts and bolts of the program here. But tell me what led you to begin this press.
Well, at the time, initially I went to film school. I studied dramatic writing, writing screenplays and plays and that sort of thing. I interned at The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And basically, the more I found out about that world, the less I wanted to be a part of it. So rather than moving to Los Angeles, I moved to San Diego and ended up marrying my wife out there. And we ended up picking up a book. At the time, too, I got more into fiction writing, seeing it as a pure form of all that. Rather than, you know, writing something and selling it and then having 50 people meddle with it, I saw it as a more direct connection between writer and reader. And I picked up a book called The Business of Books, and the subtitle pretty much says it all. It's how international conglomerates took over publishing and changed the way we read. At the same time, I was discovering a number of small presses, Dalkey Archive, Soft Skull, Akashic Books, and that just led me to want, you know, kind of lit the spark to want to try to do something and start my own small press. So I enlisted the help of my brother, my wife, who went along willingly for the most part.
So it's a family business.
It's a family-run business, correct.
Tell me about the name $2 Radio. How did you come to that name?
Well, at the time, we were living in San Diego, and I was bartending, and there was this old belligerent man who was really drunk, and I was doing my best to ignore him, trying really hard to do that. And it came off as that, and he realized that, and he said, don't mind me, I make more noise than a $2 radio. So it stuck with me. I wrote it down.
You remembered that.
That's good. It did, yeah.
Let me ask each of you, Cassie and Kevin, you've talked about small boutique presses before, things that don't necessarily are invested to make a lot of money. I mean, there's a sacrifice involved here for you and your family in doing this. You, Cassie, said that Eric's books, you've seen them in New York. In book shops in New York. Tell me about the importance of boutique presses, small presses.
Well, I think that they're keeping the real literary scene alive. That which was, say, going on in the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, before, as Eric referenced, the big conglomerates took over and started guiding the way that we read. And for example, now, really, Barnes & Noble is guiding the way we read. So in the earlier years, let's say the mid-20th century, when we had independent booksellers, and there are still many in New York and in Brooklyn, you walk in and on the tables are displays of books. And it's not just the newest books that have come out, but all sorts of books from big presses, small presses, the classics, things that they're recommending. So they bring to your attention that which you don't know about.
And you'd like to know about.
Yes, and they're incredible novels, nonfiction, and Three Lives and Company, which is in the Village. Every time I have gone there, they have had one of $2 Radio Press's books out. I believe one of them was Scott Bradfield's book, The Watching the Girl Pass By,
The people who watched her pass by.
The people who watch her pass by. And I was very excited to see that, because that told me what they are aware of and what they are bringing to their readership. So these small press books, which are getting more and more attention by the critics and also by a lot of newspapers. For example, Bellevue Literary Press, which its books have been nominated for awards, and also one of their books won the Pulitzer Prize, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago.
And sort of the Cinderella story behind that winning the Pulitzer was there was a bookseller at, I believe it was River Run Bookstore in New Hampshire, who really loved the book and felt passionately about it and recommended it to someone who was doing a reading in the store who just happened to be on the Pulitzer committee.
Mm-hmm. You never know. Be nice to everybody. Mm-hmm. Kevin, what's your view? Excuse me, I just want to get Kevin's view as well.
Well, what I would congratulate Eric on, and anyone who takes the risk of running a small press, is, you know, you do things the old-fashioned way. You still believe in editing, for one thing. One thing that really concerns me, you know, now Amazon is, anybody can take a novel they have written, doesn't matter who's looked at it, what editing process it's gone through, submit it through, get it published through Amazon and have it Kindle ready in about 24 hours and sell it on Amazon. And I think that's a kind of a disturbing trend. I wonder what's going to happen when we're awash with all this self-published work. I don't think people realize the value of editing. Of course, we want great writing, but you guys do the hard work of looking at manuscripts, right? You don't go through agents or do that kind of thing. You actually look at slush piles of manuscripts. You take chances on people you think you have a good voice, and you pour your heart and soul into marketing those books. And that's what presses should be doing. And people with tastes that go beyond just bestseller lists, you're doing them a great service, I think. So I think that's the value of what you are doing.
Well, thanks for saying that. I appreciate it. I think one of the great ideological divides between the corporate presses and indie presses is the corporate presses are sort of preoccupied with chasing trends, seeing what else is selling, and then trying to publish a similar book or a similar voice. For instance, I saw where Jeremy Lin, the basketball phenom, you know, overnight, and next thing you know, there are 7 e-books, there's a print book coming out, that sort of thing. And I think that independent presses, you know, when you're only publishing 5 or 6 books a year, you can't miss, you can't wait, you know, waste a shot on, you know, publishing something that you don't believe in just to fill a quota. And so I think independent publishers are more concerned about trying to publish literature that will sort of sway culture in some way and contribute to that. I think recently, March is Small Press Month, and in late February, there was a small press pioneer, Barney Rossett, who passed away. He ran Grove Press for a number of years. He bought it in 1951 when it only published 2 or 3 titles at the time for $3,000, and he really ended up, to me, he embodies that spirit of publishing, which I think a lot of indie presses are trying to carry on.
That's all very nice, Eric. Sell me a book.
Okay, well, a book I read recently and absolutely loved was These Dreams of You by Steve Erickson. It's his 11th book, his 9th novel. He's a hero of mine. His books are kind of tough to categorize and tough to summarize as well, but I'll do my best. I think that These Dreams of You, it follows a family on the night of Obama's election victory. They live in L.A. Their home's on the verge of foreclosure, and they've recently adopted a young girl from Ethiopia. And the matriarch of the family in L.A., when she was in Ethiopia adopting the girl, she learned that the girl's mother, birth mother, was a Muslim and had her out of wedlock. So she's concerned about whatever became of the girl's mother. She hires an investigator, which actually only ends up stirring up more problems. It's a great book and really ambitious. I think the Los Angeles Review of Books called it today's great American novel, and I'd happen to agree.
Give me the title and the author again.
These Dreams of You, by a writer named Steve Erickson.
And we will try to have these titles and authors on our website at the close of the program.
How did you find that book? Was it through the LA Review, or was there some other avenue that it came to you?
I'm a huge fan of Steve Erickson's books.
So you follow him?
Yeah. His last book, Zeroville, I think is his best. It was published in 07, and it was recently optioned by James Franco, so maybe that'll broaden
Not
its
bad,
horizons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Now, Cassie, you and I, a couple of years ago, thanks to Kevin, got to interview A.S. Byatt, the British author. And I was meant. Kevin has brought with him her latest book, which doesn't weigh 15 pounds like some of hers does. So in the few minutes we have before our break, can you just give us a précise of the latest from A.S. Byatt?
Yeah, this is A.S. Byatt. This is called Ragnarok. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. Ragnarok, R-A-G-N-A-R-O-K. Ragnarok, the End of the Gods. And it's a very short book, and it was published in response to a request from a publisher. A publisher requested some major authors to write about their favorite myth. And so this is a Norse myth about the end of the world. And it's about 100 pages long. And what's great is you get a real taste, right, a real delicious taste of A.S. Byatt's prose, her ability to write. What a stellar writer she is without getting bogged down in an incredibly lengthy narrative with multiple characters.
What grandma had for lunch in 1897.
That's exactly right.
Okay.
I'll read you just a little bit from it. This is great. This is Thor. Thor is using this massive hook to catch. He's fishing. He's fishing for the snake. The snake is so long that it goes around the entire circumference of the world. Now, this is imagination, isn't it? Highly imaginative. Thor, the thunder god, hauling her up in a rod and line. Up she came and up, more and more of her, towering like the mast of the boat. She fashioned her sore mouth on the bait and pulled. The rod arched and quivered. The god held fast, and the boat twisted in the water. The snake shook her fleshy mane and hissed poison. Okay, excellent stuff. Every page is like a prose poem in here. Completely imaginatively rich and textured. The only problem with this, I had a couple colleagues who read this as well, we kind of shared our thoughts on it, is you have this beautiful, mysterious discussion of the myth that's kind of like out of time. And then at the end, there's this little essay from Byatt herself called Thoughts on Myths, where she goes through and explains the whole thing. And it's really kind of a bummer. It's like someone coming out at the end of a movie or something, you know, to tell you what you're supposed to think about it. So they should have published it without her little end notes.
Well, you cannot read it.
Kind of broke. Yeah, just skip the end notes. It really breaks the mood.
Which makes it an 85-page book.
But I'd highly recommend it if you want to get into Byatt or just get a sampling of what she's capable of. Ragnarok, The End of the Gods. This is her latest.
She is. Let me emphasize, an author worth knowing better. I mean, she really
is. Oh, definitely.
Something
worth
terrific.
The work.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And work it is, but it is worthwhile. Mm-hmm. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend Books with Cassie Rose, Kevin Griffith, and Eric Obanoff. We'll be back in a few seconds after a break. Don't go away.
On Super Tuesday, President Obama held a press conference, and he was asked if he had any message for Mitt Romney. The president said, quote, "Good luck tonight." That will go down in history as the most enthusiastic thing ever said about Mitt Romney. I'm Peter Sagal. We will do our best to get you excited on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. 40 degrees in downtown Columbus, some sunshine today with a high near 45. Clear skies tonight, a low of 23 degrees. Sunshine for Saturday and a high of 51.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Wexner Center. Nearly Lear, performed by Susanna Hamnett, geared for ages 10 and up, reimagines the tragic story of King Lear from the viewpoint of the king's closest companion, his clown. March 9th and 10th, wexarts.org.
All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I thank you, Amy Jurevich. I'm Christopher Purdy, back with Cassie Rose, Kevin Griffith, and Eric Obanoff. We'd like to hear from you. We want to know what you're reading. 292-8513, or you can send us an email, allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to our Facebook page. Cassie Rose, I'm always, anytime you recommend a book, I tend to run out and read it. So, and you're never wrong. So what did you have?
Yes. The pressure.
Yes.
I thought today I would start with Half-Blood Blues. It just came out last week here in the United States. It's been out in England or in Europe for a while. And it's about a jazz group in the 1930s, and it takes place in Berlin and Paris and Baltimore. Two of the players, the bass player and the drummer, are from Baltimore. They're African Americans who are in Europe to escape the Jim Crow laws so they can be more expressive of their music. They have a horn player with them in Berlin, a German African, and he is exquisite, and he is sought out by Louis Armstrong, and is the band itself goes to Paris. And I have to be careful here because I know that Kevin is partway through the book, so I'm like trying to edit and not give away. But they do end up in Paris and trying to cut a record with Louis Armstrong. The intrigue in the book is from the very beginning, the horn player disappears, and he and Sid, the bass player, go out to get some milk. They have been trying to cut a record. And over again, the horn player has been saying, not good enough, not good enough. And so they give up for the night. And this is in Nazi-occupied Paris. So this is the 1930s. So he takes the chance to go out and get a glass of milk, goes into a bar, and the boots, as they called them, come into the bar, and they take Hero. His name is Hieronymus Falk, and they take him. There's mystery and intrigue about why, and that's a lot of what drives the book. It then goes to the future in 1992 because there is a Hieronymus Falk festival going on in Berlin, and the bass player and the drummer from Baltimore go to participate in that festival. And so back and forth the author takes us between this 1930s, 1938, 39 Berlin jazz scene. And that's what's fascinating to me, because I wasn't aware there was this jazz scene in Berlin. And she uses the language and the tone of the time. Many notable names that I didn't recognize, but I kept thinking I wanted to go to the internet and look them up, about the music at the time. And it's about the players who are involved in the music. The Nazi occupation is very much present, but it's in the background. And it causes a lot of the action that happens for them. I don't want to give too much more away.
Well, what's interesting to me is you and Kevin are both reading it. Are you reading it independently of one another? Mm-hmm. That is a real selling point.
I just found it a few days ago on the new bookshelf at the Whetstone Library. Just picked it up on a lark and started reading it, and it is great. The author's name is Ezzie Edugian. I had never heard of her. She's a Canadian African author. And from a writing standpoint, Cassie's done a great job of sort of giving a plot synopsis. And from a writing standpoint, she strikes a really great balance between readability and sort of literary merit. So I think that's good. It's an eminently readable novel as well. It's not too leaden, and it's entertaining, humorous when it needs to be, serious when
Very
it needs
so.
To be. It's a fascinating book.
Half-Blood Blues. Mm-hmm. Now, is this a first book for her, do you know?
No, it's not. It's her second.
Had you ever heard of her before? Is she someone you discovered?
I discovered her, and actually, she was shortlisted. This book was shortlisted for the Man Booker Prize in 2011, and I couldn't wait, so I ordered the book and paid the price to get it from overseas, which is interesting because you can see the two different
editions.
The two different editions, and those who are watching.
Cassie has the British edition.
The British edition.
And Kevin has the American edition.
And Eric brought up about how it's the different emphasis, because the British edition really has I think this is probably a scene in Berlin.
That's the Peace Gate, ironically enough, yeah.
And this, and the American edition shows a record label.
Yeah. All right. So,
highly recommended.
Yeah, if you love music, you would love this from
Absolutely.
A music history perspective.
Yes. Yes.
Half-Blood Blues. I have a recommendation, too. I don't usually do this, but if you're of a certain age and remember the Watergate hearings, would be enthralled with a new novel by Thomas Mallon called Watergate, which you are there, and you know it's funny. A lot of we don't think of that as funny at all, but his gift as a writer is such that, you don't really notice the loathsomeness of some of what went on, but it's funny and shocking at the same time, and it's a great read as well. Thomas Mallon, Watergate. Eric, tell me about some of the titles that you publish that you're in charge of.
Okay, we have a new book coming out in May called Radio Iris that I'm exceptionally excited about. It's by a debut novelist named Anne-Marie Kinney. We've got great endorsements for the book from Amy Bender, T.C. Boyle. If you like those writers, you might like this book. It deals with water cooler culture in a very artful and existential way. It's about a socially awkward receptionist at a company whose true function she doesn't really understand, who, although she has overheard her boss refer to himself as a businessman.
I love it already.
A businessman in quotes.
I love it already, yeah.
And strange things start happening. Her boss's behavior becomes even more erratic. She discovers a mysterious stranger living in the office suite next door, and her coworkers begin gradually disappearing.
Tell me the title again.
Radio Iris.
And how did this get to you?
It was submitted to us by the author's agent.
So you really read what comes in the door. Maybe we shouldn't
say.
I don't want you to be
yeah.
drowning and stuff, so maybe I shouldn't say that.
No, but. We are. I mean, it does take us a little while to get to the submissions, but we do read everything.
How many readers do you have?
For the most part, there's myself, my brother, and we have someone who works for us part-time as an editor who lives out in L.A., works at a great bookstore out there called Skylight Books.
Do you do most of the work at home?
Yeah, all
okay.
of it.
All right.
With
okay.
my son holding my thumb.
Oh, that's so nice. That's great. When he's older, he can work. Never mind that. 292-8513 is the number to call. Let us know what you've been reading. AllSides@WOSU is the email address. You can send us an email or you can find us on Facebook. And I have to ask Kevin about Dan Shaun's new collection of short stories, because I'm a fan of his, but I haven't read this yet.
Yeah, this is interesting, because I'm a huge fan of Dan Shaun, too. An Ohio guy. Now he teaches at Oberlin. He's not originally from Ohio. He's from Nebraska. But he teaches at Oberlin, and he's been there for a couple of years. His first, technically it wasn't his first book of short stories, it was his second, but his first one of note, which was Among the Missing, that was a National Book Award finalist. Among the Missing is one of the greatest collections of short stories I think I've read. This is his latest collection of short stories called Stay Awake. And I was really looking forward to reading it, but I've had really mixed feelings now that I've gone into it, because I don't know how I'm supposed to take some of these stories sometimes because they're really they're supposed to be borderline horror stories without going into Stephen King territory. So he has a hard task here. You know, he wants to be maintain his literary reputation while yet writing horror fiction. And so what you have is story after story where we have the what we might call the pathetic man, right, plot. You know, there's a pathetic man. In one story, Patrick Lane Flabbergasted, we had the main character, both of his parents have committed suicide. They committed suicide in an upstairs bedroom and left him a note telling him to call the police. And he just sits there alone, surrounded in squalor. Eight of his friends have died, and he's decided not to go to any of their funerals just because he's too lazy and has nothing better to do. And then the story just gets even more optimistic from that point. But and then the title, and then I got to the title story, Stay Awake, and believe it or not, it's about a couple that has a two-headed baby. Okay, so there we go. They have a two-headed baby. And then right before the baby is supposed to have surgery to remove one of the heads, incredibly risky surgery.
I don't mean to laugh. The
protagonist of the story gets in an auto accident and breaks like every single bone in his body and is in traction. And that's how the story ends, with him in traction wondering what happened with this surgery on the two-headed baby. And at that point I said, maybe, you know, it might be wise to put this down, reassess my position on Dan Shaun and move forward. But I would say, if you're a Dan Shaun fan, you should read it. And if you want to find something that's different, believe me, take a look at it.
Tell me the title of the collection again.
Stay Awake by Dan Shaun.
Do you know if he keeps you off balance like that, that could be the mark of a very good writer.
Yes, that's right. That's why I'm not ready to dismiss him out of hand, because he's good. And so I'm thinking I might put it aside and go back to it maybe with a...
But don't you think that fans will... they're probably not going... Will they take that moment that the two of you have taken and think, this may be the mark of his great talent, versus being very disappointed because they want predictability? They're going back to him because they have been and had enjoyable books before. So now they're picking up this new book that's not going to be anything like what they expected. Do you think they'll have the patience for it?
I don't know. You wonder, because the one problem is he's with a writer. to his credit, he set the bar very high with Among the Missing, and so now can mm-hmm. he, you know, cross his own bar there, jump over his own bar. I don't think this one does, but mm-hmm. I don't want to dismiss it out of hand either, so I'll probably go back to it.
We have had several email messages. Kelly recommends Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo, which has been featured on NPR. It's a nonfiction book about a woman writing about the most terrible parts of Indian neighborhoods on the continent and the poverty and horror there. She writes, it really puts life into perspective, and I want to remember these people in India when I think I have a problem. And I remember hearing that interview, and it was very compelling. The book is Behind the Beautiful Forevers by Catherine Boo. Michael came to us on Facebook and recommends anything by Mitch Albom. His newest, Have a Little Faith, is a true story. And I have a question for the three of you. Sarah has sent us a tweet. She's looking for a recommendation for an easy, fun read for spring break, something she can read in 2 or 3 days. Discuss.
I would go, Kevin, do you want to, what is it, The One Day?
One Day.
Yeah, The One Day.
David Nichols, excellent book.
Really? One Day by David Nichols.
Mm-hmm. For spring break, that would be mm-hmm. a great one, too.
I always recommend, anyone asks me a question like mm-hmm. that, what just mm-hmm. is a good read, Kevin? One Day, David Nichols.
Give me a little thumbnail.
Well, go ahead, Cassie, you're good at that.
Well, it's because I discovered it last summer because I knew that the film was coming out in August, and I thought I wanted to read the book before the film came out. I didn't see the movie. But it's about one day in July and this one couple that has met in Scotland and graduating and going on with their life, and they're in love, but they're very different in their lives. So mm-hmm. the author focuses on that same day in July.
It's St. Crispin's Day, right?
That's correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's St. Crispin's Day. Every day throughout their adulthood comes back and focuses on them that day. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful book. I mm-hmm. as I said, I didn't see the movie.
Did I miss mm-hmm. the movie? I missed the movie.
It's very involving and
some people
fun.
might tag it as chick lit. It is not.
No.
I'm a man. I enjoyed it. I cried too at the end. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah,
I always like that. If it makes me cry, I'm happy. So that's very good. 292-8513 is the number. Before we take a call, I want to ask Eric for another recommendation.
Okay, this falls into the fun category. I recently read a book called Seguero, which the subtitle is The Life and Adventures of Bobby Allen Bird. It's by a writer named Carson Mell, and he's made a number of short films that have screened at Sundance and other film festivals, the best known of which is Chanto, which is about Bobby Allen Bird's relationship with his pet monkey. Basically, he's an aging rock star, and Seguero just charts the course of his success, you know, from him first writing songs to The Neighborhood Baby to, you know, being an uber successful musician. It's really funny. He's got a great wit and style. And if you check out the short films, I do that first just because Carson Mell, who narrates the animated videos, has a great drawl to his voice. So if you imagine reading the book with his voice, it'll enhance the experience that much more.
Give us the author's name one more time, too, so people...
Carson Mell.
Carson Mell. That's a recommendation from Eric Obanoff from $2 Radio. And we have a call from Mike in Columbus. He has a recommendation from us. Hi, Mike. Are you there?
There's an author out of Worcester, Ohio. His name is Bob Adamoff. And kind of late in life author. He's written about 6 or 7 books now. And what's particularly interesting is they're all somehow tied to Put-in Bay, South Bass Island, kind of a central character. In some cases, it might remind you of Clive Cussler novels, tying in some historical things and then some murder mystery stuff that happens today, and it all kind of gets tied together at the end. Nice man, and I think you might have fun with a lot of individual familiar places, you know, Put-in Bay and Sandusky and all that. So,
Mike, give me the title one more time, okay?
Well, there's I think his most recent book is called Tan Lines.
Tan Lines, okay.
Yeah, and he's got about 6 or 7 books now, all with a central character in each of the books, a little bit like a Dirk Pitt kind of a guy. So he's fun, a self-publisher, I might add, as well.
Okay. Yeah. Mike, thanks for the recommendation from an Ohio-based author. We're glad to hear that. Panel, put your recommendation hats on. Natalia in Columbus needs a recommendation. Hi, Natalia, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Hi. My son, he's 12 years old, and he's had such difficulty with reading. And I've asked him about it. He says he finds books boring. He's reading at a third grade level. I want to find something that's going to inspire him, that's going to open up his imagination to books. Any recommendations?
Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead, Kevin.
I talked about it on the show a couple shows ago when we were talking about the best books of the year. The name of the author has escaped me, but the title is St. Louis Armstrong Beach.
Which Beautiful. I read that.
It's an excellent book. It's about a boy who plays clarinet, and it's right before Katrina hits in New Orleans, set in New Orleans, and he has to get out of the city. And he gets out of the city, but then he realizes he left something behind and tries to make his way back in. That's a riveting story. I have children. They read it and loved it, and I loved it as well. So St. Louis Armstrong Beach, that's an excellent book. I strongly recommend that.
Yeah, I can vouch for that. Anybody else with a... Okay. Your son's a little young yet, isn't he?
He is a little young.
Okay.
I started to read a book called Scurvy Gunda to my daughter. She's a little too young for it. She's about six. But it's about around a 12-year-old boy, his relationship with his imaginary friend, who everyone's trying to get him to ditch, this pirate named Scurvy Gunda, and chaos ensues. It's a fun read, and it's by a writer named Chris McCoy.
I like that. I might read that.
Well, what about The Phantom Tollbooth?
Phantom Tollbooth is great, too. The Wind in the Willows is one of my favorites from forever. I mean, that can be enjoyed by anybody, really, by Kenneth Graham. It's about 80 years old now, but it's a magnificent book. But, The Phantom Tollbooth is great.
And its 50th anniversary edition just came out last year, and it's very imaginative and, you know, I don't know how old the little boy is, but, you know, he goes through the toll booth and into a different time, and it's very imaginative.
Our young friend is 12 who called in, so I think that's about right with that age group, so that's terrific. We have time for one more call from Sharon, who has a recommendation. Hi, Sharon.
Michael Korda has a new book out called Hero. It's about Lawrence of Arabia. And the great thing is that he has access to the British archives that have confirmed that what Lawrence wrote, he did, and Korda also discusses the fact that his uncle, Alex Korda, was the original purchaser of film rights for The Revolt in the Desert, which was the edited version of The Seven Pillars of Wisdom. And Korda sold both of those film rights, or sold the film rights to Sam Spiegel on the same day that he sold Sam Spiegel The African Queen.
Oh.
And it's a fascinating book. It's a bit of a thick one. It's got about 130 pages of notes, and it's one of the first biographies of Lawrence that I've ever come across that has full color photographs of the actual people and the actual artwork that was done for both The Revolt in the Desert and Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
Sharon, I thank you for the recommendation, a biography of Lawrence of Arabia by Michael Korda. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is All Sides Weekend / Books. We are taking a break and we'll be back in 90 seconds. Don't go away.
Of the next fresh air, the start of the Civil War, and how national leaders and ordinary citizens responded to the chaos and uncertainty. We'll look at how the Civil War continues to reverberate today. We talk with Adam Goodhart, author of the book 1861, which is now out in paperback. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Looking for an easy way to support our station? How about joining our Sustaining Giving program? As a sustainer, your membership never expires. No more reminders in the mail, and your member card renews annually. The ongoing support of sustaining members saves 89.7 NPR News time and money, and helps focus more of your support on news programming. Make every dollar count and become a sustainer. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Midland Theater, presenting the world-famous Glenn Miller Orchestra, recreating the sounds of Miller's vintage World War II jazz and swing tunes, Sunday, March 11th at 4 p.m. Tickets at midlandtheater.org.
40 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high near 45. Clear skies tonight, a low of 23 degrees. Sunshine on Saturday, a high of 51, and a nice day on Sunday. Sunshine with a high of 62. All Sides Weekend continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Thank you, Amy Jurevich, our producer, who, by the way, just finished grad school. So congratulations very much in order. I hope your husband buys you a car. We are going to talk about books, continue to talk about books with Eric Obanoff, Cassie Rose, and Kevin Griffith. We want your phone calls, 292-8513. You can also email at WOSU.org. We have had a recommendation from Linda. She's reading the new biography of Charles Dickens by Claire Tomalin. This is Dickens' 200th birthday year. I was amazed to discover he was writing Oliver Twist and Nicholas Nickleby as magazine installments at the same time. I haven't read that yet, and I'm a Dickens fan. I'm reading Bleak House now, 10 pages a day. You can't do it any other way. 10 pages a day.
Yeah. That's a big one.
That's huge.
Yeah, I just finished Tom Jones, 10 pages a day. I started it at Christmas, but it was my appointment. Every day I read something. Mm-hmm. Cassie Rose, you said you have a book with you that if Gone with the Wind had not been published, this book would be all over the world famous.
That's what the literary chatter on it is or was. And that's what drew me to read it. I got wind of it in one of the used and rare books catalogs that came through, and that was the descriptor that brought it to my attention. The story, it's None Shall Look Back by Caroline Gordon, and she actually was a very prolific, well, she wrote 9 novels, I guess, in the mid-20th century, and was very highly respected, well-praised, good books. This one, she had the unfortunate timing to publish in 1937. Gone with the Wind was published in 1936. So it pretty much drowned in the wake of Scarlett O'Hara and Rhett Butler. A very different take on the Civil War, but some say it's the better take on it. And again, if Gone with the Wind had not been published, this might have been the one that would have been in the forefront. Its strength lies in the battles, though. There is certainly, it opens with a plantation scene, and there is the Allard family, and the plantation is a tobacco plantation in Kentucky. There's a birthday party, introduces all the characters. The sons are riding home from school to join Colonel Nathan Bedford Forrest to go fight at Fort Donelson. And then we go into part two, and it is about the Fort Donelson battle. I decided to read the first edition. I didn't want to read the Southern Classic version that is out in paperback because I didn't want the notes, the preface, the interpretation. I wanted to read it in its original form. What I missed was and I don't know if the paperback that's out now has maps in it, but I missed having maps because I'm not well-versed in the battles. It follows Reeves Allard, one of the cousins of this plantation family, into battle. He's a scout for the colonel. And she does a very, very good job of taking us into what was happening at the time and putting us into the binoculars of both Union and Confederate commanders. She takes us back and forth between what happens at the plantation. Union soldiers show up. They burn down the house. Also going, one of the daughters from the plantation, Patriarch, goes to live in Georgia with her new husband. So it's very much Gone with the Wind-like, but it doesn't have the emotional drama of Scarlett O'Hara and the romance.
Is what she does, does that make up for that? Do you miss the emotional drama? Do you need to have some more romance in this book, or does she get you there anyway with battles?
She gets you there with battles, but I think today's reader, and because you do have the influence of the image of Gone with the Wind, you want more from Reeves Allard and Lucy, his wife. And that is actually, though, where she took some hits by the critics. They do say that her characters lack warmth. And I did also, I wrote about this on The Longest Chapter, and I did say that is the one thing I didn't feel emotionally drawing to the characters, but it more the battles and what she writes about gave more than made up for it, because I came away with a greater image of the Civil War soldier, what went on, some of the battles and of the war than I did with Gone with the Wind. And Gone with the Wind is one of the few books in my reading career I've read twice.
Well, I was just going to ask the panel, has anybody read Gone with the Wind? You have twice. Kevin, the professor, has not.
No.
Eric, the publisher, has not. And Christopher, the mouth, has not. So,
see, and that's, that surprises me. And although a friend of mine who is very, very, very well read approached me a couple of months ago and said, should I read Gone with the Wind? And my first remark was, absolutely. And then I stopped. I mean, this is a person who's read the Peloponnesian Wars and Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs. So he takes on, you know, great books. And then I stopped and I thought, no, I don't think he's going to like Gone with the Wind. But I thought he would like this one. None Shall Look Back.
Well, all right. Great recommendation. 292-8513. Give us a call. Let us know what you're reading. You can also send an email to allsides@wosu.org. The Dickens reference reminded me of something in the 20th and 21st century. This is this year, the 60th anniversary of Elizabeth's ascension to the throne. And there is a hot new biography of her out by Sally Bedell Smith called Elizabeth the Queen that I just finished. I have to tell you, one weekend at Balmoral is much like another. I mean, you know, it does go on. However, you do come away with a new respect for the life that she, frankly, has had to live for 85 years and still going. So I do recommend that as well. Speaking of recommendations, Eric, you're up.
I was recently at AWP, which is the Association of Writers and Writing Professionals or Writing Programs in Chicago, and they have a great book fair in at the conference. And I was drawn to this booth where a publisher, Siglio Press, they publish uncommon books that live at the intersections of art and literature. Mm. And they published a book called Everything Sings, Maps for a Narrative Atlas by Dennis Wood, which is just a series of maps that focus on a small town in North Carolina, everything from which houses have jack-o'-lanterns on their front porch to traffic patterns. A book that I ended up picking up was called Sprawl by a writer named Danielle Dutton, and it puts the suburbs under a microscope. She has a great quote. She says, "The suburbs are where there's no real incentive to be sincere." And the book is kind of if all the actions or emotions were sort of drained away from suburban life and you were just left with the fragments and the memories, that's sort of what Sprawl is. It's not action-packed. There are no war scenes. It's just sort of it was inspired by a series of still-life photographs by Laura Latinsky called Hardly More Than Ever. But it's funny and it's graceful, and she's a great writer, so...
Funny is good, and writers we haven't heard from before are always worth hearing more about. So thank you for that recommendation very much. We have a couple of calls lined up. We have a call from Hilliard, a recommendation. I think the name is Tirza. I hope I get that correctly. You'll correct me. Hi.
Hi there. I'm recommending Alice Hoffman's The Story Sisters. It's, you know, like a lot of her books, has a very magical sort of flavor. It's three sisters who have a secret language, and one of them descends into like a sort of madness and drug addiction, and it just cycles around these three sisters as they grow from, you know, early adolescence to adulthood. It's just beautiful.
Is it a tragedy?
In some ways, yes. There's some death in there, but in the end, you know, one of the sisters sort of triumphs and you know, finds the strength of that bond they had, reconnects with that. It's really wonderful.
We thank you for the recommendation of The Story Sisters by Alice Hoffman. Thank you very much. We also have had an email from Kevin in Granville. He recommends crime noir novels by, I'm going to say this wrong, Dwayne Swierczynski, including Severance Package. My wife would like those, so I'll bring that home with me. So thank you for that recommendation. We have Jim on the line from Columbus. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I got for Christmas Conquering Gotham by Jill Johns. My daughter gave it to me. It is an incredible history of the Pennsylvania Railroad, the times of the turn of the century, and the specific challenges of building tunnels under the Hudson and Penn Station. It's a history that combines all sorts of technology. It explains Tammany Hall and the rise of Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, it's an incredible piece of work.
Tell me, Concurring Gotham?
Conquering.
Conquering, you know, Gotham, okay.
Right.
By Jill Jonas.
J-O-N-N-E-S. It's a Viking.
Okay, thank you so much for the recommendation. I'm going to pick that one up because I'm a displaced New Yorker myself, like you are. And also, we have a recommendation from Patricia in Gahanna. Hi there.
Wow, I'm going to pick up Conquering Gotham.
Me too,
that
yeah.
That sounds fascinating. How about that? Okay, I'm calling. My book is a nonfiction book, Paris, My Sweet, by Amy Thomas, and it's about a young woman who moves to Paris, and she just explores chocolate shops and food in Paris, and it's kind of a love letter to Paris, part love letter to New York. She compares and contrasts the two, but mostly she's talking about the sights and the chocolate and the bread and the food, and I am devouring this
take
book.
This the right way, but you make it sound erotic. I mean it's just, which is not a bad thing, you know. I mean, it's a great way to sell
every
books.
Page, I'm just, ooh.
Okay, Paris, My Sweet by Amy Thomas. Yes. I'm going to leave it right there. Thank you very much, Patricia, for that call and that recommendation. I want to give Kevin a chance to chime in with another recommendation for us. Kevin,
all right.
Griffith.
As long as we're on nonfiction books, and we want to lighten things up a little bit. I'm still thinking about Paris. That was
great.
Yeah,
I know.
Yeah. this is a fascinating book. I picked this up at the Whetstone Library as well. It's called Mail Order Mysteries by Kirk Damaris. And this is a great concept for a nonfiction book. What he did is he went back and looked through all those great comic book ads from the 70s, you know, ads for like X-ray specs and whoopee cushions and things like that. And he went through and he actually looked at the ads, he analyzed the ads, and then he took photos of what you actually got when you ordered, you know, you ordered the thing.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So this is great. So like, for instance, the ad is, we've all seen these on comic books, the ad is for a 7-foot monster-sized monster made out of durable polyurethane, okay, with glow-in-the-dark eyes. So you think, he talks about this, says, we imagined a 7-foot action figure made of durable polyurethane. Then you see a photo of what you actually got, and what you actually got was like a print of Frankenstein on two garbage bags that you can like put up on your wall. And it's hilarious. One is for like a life-size bat that you remotely control, and it's just a little rubber bat with a string on it. And it's page after page of this, and I read it, I was fascinated, and I have two sons, and they both loved it as well. Like, one is for inflatable lifelike ladies' legs, and these inflatable legs look nothing like human legs.
Yeah, your son's
yeah,
built,
I know,
didn't you?
Yeah. but it's page after page of this, and it's very kitschy, very fun to read. Beautifully illustrated, and it's called Mail Order Mysteries by Kirk Damaris. I highly recommend it, and I have two sons, a 9-year-old and a 15-year-old, and they both read it and loved it as well. So.
God, we're weird, I must tell you.
That's great.
Call us if you're weird, or even if you're not, 292-8513. Cassie, you have Where Things Come Back. I'm reading it upside down. Did I do right?
Mm-hmm. You did right by John Corey Whaley. He won the Michael Prince Award by the American Library Association. That's the Newbery, the Caldecott, and then the Prince Award, which is for outstanding young adult literary fiction. And I picked up this book because of the convergence of things or descriptions on it. One, it was the odds. It was not the odds on favorite. And two, they were saying it had some intense topics about it. And also that it was his debut novel. And it does have intense topics in it. But Kevin and I were talking last time about how with young adult literature, you can come to it with a beginner's mind. And so intense for adult literature is not the same as when it's young adult. And this takes place in a very small Arkansas town, Lily, Arkansas, 17-year-old. Over the summer, his his first-person viewpoint of a lot of things that go on that, as I'm going to say them, are intense. It's suicide, it's death from drug addiction, and the disappearance of his little brother. But because he's 17, this is young adult, there is not that horrible intensity. You don't have Emma Donahue's Room going on here. It's a lot... An overview of the story also in terms of where things come back is that an ornithologist is in town because he has spotted the Lazarus woodpecker, which has been extinct since World War II. And so there is an overlay of second chances in that kind of a thematic material. And there's great hope in the story, too.
You know what I was thinking, though, as you were describing that when I was of an age to read young adult fiction, mm-hmm. or teenage fiction, it was very different back then. I mean, it was on papyrus, but I'm just saying it was, mm-hmm. I mean, you didn't have the tragedy. You didn't have the as I recall, the angst or the drama mm-hmm. that you find today. I guess we're more, I mean, with the proliferation of media, I think mm-hmm. obviously kids are exposed to more and their shock level has gone down, you know, quite a bit.
Well, and how I took it in this book was reading it was that it opens the author has the ability to share with the youth how to live in a world like this. And in the presentation of it, it's not to shock and to depress and to say this is a horrible world. This author says there are second chances and there is hope.
As we conclude, we have 3 minutes left. I want to ask Eric to wrap us up here and give me a working day in the life of someone who runs a boutique press, $2 Radio in Clintonville.
Well, you know, my son dictates a lot of what actually gets done. He's about 2 years old and he's with me. So, you know, I'll generally handle publicity, emails, that sort of thing, like trying to... come up with labels like who to send review copies of books to hopefully get some kind of press going. And I'll do that in the morning. And then when my son takes a nap, I'll read submissions or edit manuscripts. And then in the afternoon, I'll do some other type of general business, busy work.
So you and your brother's involved as well. So is he physically with you or is it all email or whatever? Is he here with you, working with you, or is he somewhere else?
No, he's somewhere else.
Okay, well, okay.
Yeah.
That works pretty well. And you've been, $2 Radio Press has been in business how long?
We got major distribution in 2008, so we kind of look at that as when we relaunched the company. We started in 2006.
I have to ask you about distribution because getting the books out there online and on table someplace must have been a challenge. How did that work out for you?
It is really difficult when you're starting out to get booksellers to take you seriously. So it definitely helped us out. And we have a good distributor who's prevented us from making a lot of stupid mistakes. We didn't have any experience in publishing before we started. So that was good to have their support. But also, like Cassie was saying, independent bookstores, they're what gave us our big boost. The people who work in bookstores are generally really passionate about what they do, and they make a point of knowing their product.
What's your website?
$2radio.com, all spelled out.
All spelled out, $2radio.com. Check that out if you're interested in the latest great books from a boutique press right here in the neighborhood. I'm Christopher Purdy. I thank you all for listening to All Sides Weekend Books. Thank you, Cassie Rose, WOSU's book critic.
My pleasure.
Proprietress of thelongestchapter.com. Thank you, Kevin Griffith, professor of poetry and creative writing at Capital University. And thank you, Eric Obanoff from $2 Press. Thank you all for being here. I'm Christopher Purdy. This is WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.